Hey everyone, welcome in to another daily editorial here on the KE Report. In this daily editorial, we are introducing a new company to the show, and in all fairness, a pretty new company to the public markets. Just went public November of last year, 2021. The company's name is Arizona Sonoran Copper Company, traded on the TSX under the symbol ASCU. And on the OTCQX under the symbol ASCUF. We are chatting with the president and CEO, George Ogilvie. Now, Arizona Sonoran is a copper company moving towards production, I think I can say, at the Cactus property in Arizona. Now, this will still take a couple of years, but this Cactus property has had a lot of historical work done on it, even a PEA that was released mid last year in August of 2021. We have a large resource that we are dealing with, a global resource of about 3.5 billion pounds of copper, both in indicated and inferred. George, since this is the first time you're on the show and the first time we are introducing Arizona Sonoran, please give us a little background on this Cactus property. How did the company come to acquire this project and any of the historic work that you can share with us, please?
Yeah, thank you, Corey. Well, this is a brownfield site. This mine was formerly in production between 1970 and 1984. It was owned by ASARCO at the time. And over its life of mine, it was producing about 25,000 tons of copper cathode production annually over its life of mine. It was in the form of a copper concentrate, which was being sent off via rail to their smelter in El Paso, Texas at the time. The mine closed in 84 when the copper prices would have been 65 cents a pound. There was lots of mineralization in the ground, but obviously it was uneconomical. So ASARCO decided to close the mine in 84. They retained the mine, however, for a further 20 years. And then in 2004, ASARCO ran into financial difficulty. They filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in the US. And at that time, Grupo Mexico stepped in to acquire a lot of their assets. This one, given that it had been dormant for 20 years, wasn't acquired by Grupo Mexico. And it therefore fell into a state trust that was actually managed by the Arizona Department of Environment and Quality. And ASARCO essentially funded the trust with $20 million. ADEQ used that money to fully or substantially remediate and close up the site. And then in 2019, my predecessor, they had some ties into the state governor's office. There was a proposal made to ADEQ to acquire the asset out of the state trust. And the company successfully acquired the asset in late 2019 by paying the state of Arizona $6 million US dollars. So that's essentially how we came about to own the property.
Well, George, let's get into the actual assets, because you have an interesting mix in that you have the previous open pit where there's some resources still there where you could do a pit pushback. You've got some stockpiles at surface. You also have the underground potential. So walk us through the PEA that you put out. What are the metrics as far as the life of mine? What would the production look like? Give us a sense of how big this project is and what it could produce.
Yeah, so we put out a PEA in August of last year. At that time, it revealed an 18-year mine life, and the average annual production would be 56 million pounds of copper cathode production annually, although it did peak at in and around 80 million pounds in years 9 and 10 when the underground workings come in and we see better grade. The project revealed a C1 cash cost at that time of $1.55 US a pound, and the all-in sustaining cost was $1.88. We ran the resource at a $3.15 copper price, and we ran the financial and economic model at a $3.35 copper price at that time. And it revealed an NPV8 after tax of $312 million US dollars. and an IRR after tax of 33%. Because it's a brownfield site and it already has some existing infrastructure on site, it minimizes the timelines to commercial production and the CapEx requirements. So about a year ago, we were looking at $124 million of capital requirement to put this mine into production, which is very low compared to a lot of our peer groups out there. It would be fair to say, however, moving into the PFS, we are going to see capital creep because of some fixed assets that were missing in the PEA, namely a crushing plant and a conveyor stacking system. And of course, as everybody knows, we're also in an high inflationary period. But we do believe when the pre-feasibility study comes out in the late summer of this year, we will still see CapEx numbers to put this mine into production that will be sub $200 million.
Those are some pretty good capital costs in terms of bringing a copper asset into production. Running the numbers, though, in terms of that PEA, over that 18-year mine life, you would extract about 1 billion pounds of copper. As I mentioned on the intro, there's 3.5 billion pounds in the resource already. So what would the availability or options be with this extra material?
Well, there's about 2.2 billion pounds of that 3.5 billion pounds of global resource, which is leachable material. So, you know, we'll be mining about 1.2 billion pounds of contained copper with an 80% recovery to give us 1 billion pounds of produce. So there's about 1 billion pounds of leachable material that we're leaving in the ground. The reason for that is that we optimize the pit shell for cash flow and therefore NPV. And that means that the current pit shell was ran using a copper price of $2.27 a pound. And the reason for that was, as we tried to make the pit shell larger to gain access to some of the deeper leachable material at the bottom of the pit, which is already about 1,000 feet below surface, we were taking too much waste. And the current strip ratio actually is very good. It's 1.4 tons of waste to 1 ton of ore. But at higher strip ratios, as we all know, every ton of waste that we take costs us the same as a ton of ore, but we get no revenue from it. So therefore, the model was not as robust at a $2.27 copper price. Now, since putting that PEA together, which is over a year old now, we've drilled around the periphery of the pit. And in some areas, we've discovered near surface mineralization that was formerly being modeled as waste. So what that's going to mean is when we build that into the resource update coming as part of the PFS, we'll have this newly discovered mineralization coming into resource. We think we're going to be able to lay back the pit a little bit bigger in some areas to take this newly discovered material, and it will therefore give us access to some of the deeper leachable material that we're leaving in the ground that we couldn't access before because of the high strip ratio. So that's one area of opportunity. Another area of opportunity would be that over and above those 2.2 billion pounds of leachable material, we have about 1.3 billion pounds of primary sulfide that grades anywhere between 0.2 and 0.4 total percent copper. And we have engaged with a couple of companies who have patented technology on the heat leaching of a primary sulfide. We've sent off bulk samples and we should expect to see the results of that testing at the end of May with one group and at the end of July with the second group. So there might be an opportunity here with some new technology to see the heat leaching of a primary sulfide. The other opportunity on the primary sulfide would be over time, as we continue to drill and explore on the property, if we find more primary sulfide, there's definitely an option to consider a cost-benefit analysis for putting in a copper concentrator again and processing the primary chalcopyrite sulfide through a copper concentrator. Sadly, when ADEQ closed up the site over that 20-year period we referenced earlier, the copper concentrator was completely removed and sold off a site, so it no longer sits on the property.
Well, George, it sounds like there's plenty of upside in a few areas, just the ability to push back the pit and get access to some of that surface higher grade ore that's, that could be worked into the new resource estimate and into the PFS. And then, yeah, if you can figure out a way through new technology to process the sulfides using heap leach, that'd be a breakthrough, not just for your company, but many companies. And then if there's enough underground drilling that's done to define the resources and copper stays up at a higher price, accessing those sulfides with a traditional copper concentrate could be yet another value driver down the road. But I just had a question. When you're looking at this PEA and you're using price of copper in, you know, the low threes, 335, or you're talking about some of the pit shell was designed in the mid twos. I don't want to point out the obvious, but copper's at 470 right now. Does the higher copper price bring any of that that was maybe previously too high of a strip ratio back into an economic situation? Because copper prices are substantially higher than the prices that were used in those economic studies.
Yeah, it certainly does. And I mean, obviously, you know, that economic study is well over a year old. And at those times, those numbers we used were appropriate for that moment or snapshot in time. As I alluded to earlier, we're currently undertaking a pre-feasibility study, which is being led by Stantec Engineering out of Phoenix, and Samuel Engineering out of Nevada is actually doing the metallurgical work. We believe, given the long-term consensus for copper pricing on a go-forward basis is currently showing at $3.65, we certainly are going to be able to consider that type of number as a baseline for our reserve and resource calculation, which obviously is probably going to give us access to some additional reserves or resources that we didn't have before. As we alluded to earlier, though, we are in an inflationary period and there will be a rise in the CapEx. And of course, the materials that the mine uses as well, those no doubt will push up some of the operating costs as well. So it's a fine balancing act, but there's no doubt that long-term copper prices are going to be significantly higher than what we've used in the past.
So let's also talk about some of the exploration upside too, because the company does have a current program underway and some holes have already been released. This is at the Parks Sailor project, 2 kilometers west of this Cactus West pit. Take us through the exploration that is also ongoing and the potential here, please.
Yeah, so we announced last year, December, that we, as part of our budgets for this calendar year, we were initially undertaking a $3 million US dollar exploration program at Park Salier that would drill basically 12 holes. And this was on the back of 4 historical holes, 2 that had been drilled by Asarco and 2 by the company about 18 months ago. And we've currently released the first 4 holes from that drill program. And we've had some incredible intercepts over many hundreds of feet, well in excess of 1% copper, particularly in the enriched holes. So for example, hole number 45 came back at 595 feet at 1.29% total copper. There's also molybdenum associated with the enriched and primary material. Hole number 65 came back with 439 feet. At 0.92 total percent copper, and hole number 57 came back at 302 feet with 1.23% copper. Based on the geophysics and the geochemistry and the signature that we get back from the size of this deposit, it appears to be of a size that could be as large or if not larger than the original Cactus West discovery that Asarco, you know, discovered in the late 1960s. We've looked at it from a volumetric perspective, and we believe there's anywhere between 40 to 90 million tons of copper leachable material in the ground at Park Salier between 1 and 1.3% that would yield an additional 1 to 2.3 billion pounds of leachable material. And then on top of that, there's potentially another 150 to 750 million pounds of primary chalcopyrite sulfide based on the work conducted to date. So our intention is probably to aggressively drill Park Salier out in the second half of the year after we complete our initial 12-hole program. By the summer, we'll have an internal resource on Parkselia, and we would then aggressively drill out Parkselia with the goal of bringing it into as a maiden resource into the bankable feasibility study, which is on course for being released late in this calendar year.
Yeah, George, I suppose I was going to ask you is like it with a, if it could be that big of a resource at Parkselia, it seems like it should definitely be part of the plan, but it sounds like it won't make the cutoff for the PFS, but it could be in the bankable feasibility study once you have some time to drill it out and get a resource put on it. So that's going to be interesting to follow along with the company. Just one other exploration target that we could just briefly mention is there's also this northeast extension area that's an earlier stage target, but maybe just briefly talk about why you're animated by that target.
Yeah, well, it's the same situation. ASARCO drilled a couple of historical holes there. They hit the copper porphyry system about 1,000 feet down the hole. They stayed away from it because they were looking for near-surface mineralization that would be open pittable. They weren't interested in going underground at the northeast extension. So it would be our intention late this year, once we've got some Parkselia substantially drilled out in a maiden resource, that we would probably turn our attention to the northeast extension heading into 2023. We believe that the same copper porphyry system will exist there. And given that it only sits 1 kilometer away from Cactus East, which is part of our PEA and PFS, which is going to be our underground mine on this project, it would be very easy to drive across a 1 kilometer drift from the Cactus East, eventually when it's into production, into the northeast extension. And any mineralization that occurs there could be mined through Cactus East and brought to surface. And given at that time, we would have the leaching pads in play. We would have an SXEW plant that would be modular so we could expand it. All of the infrastructure essentially would be sitting on site. And we believe that, there's huge economies of scale, obviously on this project, well beyond what the current PEA is showing the market.
All right. Very interesting, George. There's a lot going on with this company, all with kind of that relatively near-term production possibility. Very interesting. Can we discuss some of the team? It is your first time on the show. So a little background on yourself and maybe one or two other people that you would like to highlight on the Arizona Sonoran Copper team.
Well, I'm a mining engineer with 32 years of experience from Glasgow, Scotland. When I graduated way back in 1989, I went to work for the Anglo-American group of companies. I cut my teeth in South Africa in the gold division for 8 years in probably some of the most challenging and toughest mines in the world, given the depth and the complexity and the numbers working on those mines. I was very fortunate in 97 to get a transfer over to Anglo Base Metals. And at that time, they owned Hudson Bay Mining and Smelting. So I spent 7 years up in northern Manitoba cutting my teeth in base metal mines and bulk mining, obviously with mobile equipment when compared to, the very intense labor and mining methods in South Africa. I then went to work for Dynatec and FNX in the Sudbury Nickel Camp for Terry McGibbon and Tony McCooch, bringing some of the old Inco mines at McCreedy West and Levack back into production. Then jumped over to Rambler Meadows and Mining in 2007, and we started up that company. And over a period of 3.5 years, we got the mine financed and brought into production, raised the capital for it, listed it on the venture and the AIM, and put the mine into production. And then the chairman of that company was also the chairman of Kirkland Lake Gold, a Mr. Harry Dobson. He'd asked me to go into Kirkland Lake in 2013 and turn that company around. We brought in Eric Sprott as non-executive chairman, changed out some of the other members of the board, changed the business plan at the Macassa mine, and over a period of 3 quarters, we turned that mine around and doubled the production by increasing the grade. We did the acquisition of St. Andrew Goldfields and took Kirkland Lake from a 90,000 ounce annual producer to 250,000 ounces. And over a 3-year period, the share price went from $2.33 to $15 a share. I exited in the summer of 2016 and then jumped into the infamous Rubicon story. At that time, it was going through the CCAA process. We restructured the company. And essentially, over time, we went back to basics and did all the proper engineering. And last year, summer, Evolution Mining jumped up and acquired the company for a 54% premium to the 20-day VWAP price, which was a great outcome for all of the shareholders of the company. And I was very fortunate in joining this company that I was given the opportunity to do 6 weeks of my own due diligence before joining the company officially in July of last year. And since joining the company, I've put $2.8 million of my own money into the company at a weighted average price of $2.48 Canadian. Today, the company currently trades in and around $2.10 Canadian. Of course, I've had a lot of success in my career, but it wouldn't have been possible without having great people and great teams around me to support me. I'm very delighted that to join this company, I have Ian McMullen, who's a former VP of mining with Klondex. For those of your listeners who follow the gold space, obviously, Klondex was sold several years ago to Midas. Ian has a lot of experience in Nevada with heat leach operations and not just open pit, but also underground mining. And then I think another key component was my previous CFO at Battle North Gold, or Rubicon, as we renamed the company. He joined me in January of this year here at Arizona Sonoran. Nick Niklokakis, VP Finance, 27 years of experience. He's raised over $2 billion in the capital markets himself, a former employee with Barrick and Placer Dome and then Barrick. And Nick was brought in specifically with the project financing in mind at the end of the year, as we said earlier, where we expect that we're going to have to raise somewhere between $175 and $200 million US dollars. So there are other members of the team, all based out of Tempe in Arizona, which is very close to the project. The company is obviously continuing to execute on its plan and moving forward with the assistance of the executive management team.
All right, George, we're going to wrap it up here. I think that provides a nice overview of the company. In future segments, we will get into a couple of the other fundamentals, such as share structure and cash in the bank. But my understanding is the company has enough cash to take them to the feasibility study. Again, if anybody has any follow-up questions for George regarding anything here going on at Arizona Sonoran, please email us either fleck@kereport.com or shad@kereport.com. We will get those addressed for you. And George, we're going to follow up probably in a couple of weeks, hopefully on the back of some more news. But George, appreciate the introduction to the company and please keep us up to date on future news.
Great. Thank you, Corey. Thank you, Shad.